I dream a lot, and I think a lot of organizations aren't allowed to dream. We're not allowed to think big. We're not allowed to have our Tesla moments, our Google moments.
I've always had this deep conviction for people who could be passed up every day, could be very easily forgotten. Everyone should be known, everyone should be cared for, and everyone should be loved.
It started with Ceci's story and that passion for a friend and that love for a friend, but now it's turned into like, I have a passion just for the rights of humanity.
Thanks for listening to the Classy Podcast. I'm Tori Callahan on the marketing team at Classy, a technology company on a mission to mobilize and empower the world for good. The Classy Podcast tells the stories of leaders shaping our future in the biggest and smallest ways. Each week, we realize the catalysts that define their path, extract their ideas, and share them with you in hopes of inspiring a generation that is mobilized to drive change. On this episode, we're joined by Dirk Van Velzen, the founder and executive director of the Prison Scholar Fund. Dirk is a founder that has excelled amazingly in the face of adversity. I'll sum it up with these two facts. He spent almost 20 years in prison, and he also just received President Obama's Volunteer Service Award. Are you intrigued yet? Let's jump in. Well, Dirk, it's an honor to have you with us today. So thank you so much for joining us on the Classy Podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking me. It's really quite a treat.
I am so excited about this conversation because your story is really incredible, definitely a unique one. So before we dive into kind of where you're coming from and your past, I was really hoping that you could just give us a short elevator pitch of what Prison Scholars Fund is and what you're trying to solve for.
You bet. I'd be happy to. So the Prison Scholar Fund provides funding and programs for incarcerated students. Now, historically, we just funded paper-based courses that the inmates could do through the mail with no institutional support. But now we're expanding the program to partner with Departments of Corrections so we can bring the programs into the prison. And what we really want to do is understand how education reduces recidivism and also increases employment. So since we have a different type of educational program than other people have, we really want to measure the impact of distance education, especially online learning for incarcerated students.
Awesome. And could you actually explain what distance learning is?
Sure, yeah. So distance learning, in some contexts, is on paper through the mail where the inmates have textbooks and study guides in their cells, and they do the assignments and they mail them. Then the instructors get the assignments, grade them, mail them back. So you have a big turnaround between assignments. But also there's online learning. And online learning is basically you're doing all the coursework online through the university. And online learning can be really robust nowadays. So instead of just one person working independently, they work with a cohort, they work with a class, there's a lot of feedback from the instructor, there's videos. There's been a lot of criticism about online programs and high attrition rates, but those are usually just the massive open online courses. The ones that are actually paid for that people work with the university at, they're actually more robust.
So cool. So what cities are you guys working in right now?
So we were in 22 states. And of course, since I just got out last year and we're rebuilding operations, we're kind of balancing the capacity building of the nonprofit, which is getting the infrastructure and getting the programs in place, with actually program delivery. So we've only funded three people recently. And we got them, you know, going on their educational journey again. And those were people we had funded in the past. And for the programs we're trying to bring in with the online program, that's through the University of Washington. And we have a partnership where that program is going to be in basically in Walla Walla, Washington. There's a big prison, and we'll bring in the program there.
So cool. So how big is Prison Scholar Fund now?
Not very big. So it's really, even though we had historical data from, we started in 06, we helped 110 people. We had some really great data from that. But now, as we're scaling back up, a lot of time is spent, you know, investing in the actually building the organization. And so since we spent a lot of time doing that, we really can't serve too many people, even though we really want to. You know, we're underfunded for programs, and we have to spend all our money building infrastructure. You know, so that said, we have three people we're sending to school right now, and that's really exciting, but we really want to do a whole lot more.
Definitely. Well, you guys are doing great work, So I really want to segue into sort of your story. I want to go back and understand your path getting to this point, actually starting with your incarceration. So first, for our listeners who aren't familiar with who you are, how many days has it been since you were released from prison?
Oh, I actually don't know the days because I haven't been counting, but it's been since May of 2015.
That's incredible, and you've done so much since then.
Well, thank you.
So let's go back in time and unpack how you got from prison to founding and being the ED of Prison Scholar Fund. So it's 1999. You just took your first step into prison. Who was Dirk at that point, and what was going through your head?
Oh, yeah. So Dirk at that point didn't really want to be in prison, of course. But there's not much you can do about that. So I really kind of tried to figure out what I was going to do with myself. And I really didn't have a good idea. I was, you know, kind of balancing just changing the way I did my crimes to not do it again or not get caught again. And then as I really had to develop a strategy for what I wanted to do, I was basically reading a novel a day. And after doing that for a few months, I kind of figured out, as long as I'm reading a book a day, I might as well be learning something. So that's when I tried to get the Pell Grant and go to school. Then I found out that the Pell Grant was taken away from inmates back in 94. So I was kind of stuck. I didn't have the funds to go to school. Now I kind of decided that's what I wanted to do because, education had always been important in my family. I just never really pursued it. So my dad wasn't really available to help because we had a falling out when I went to prison. But it was after struggling for a while, he finally stepped up to pay for my education at Penn State. But during that journey, I discovered so many people around me who were just as passionate, just as motivated, and just as hardworking as I was, but they didn't have the funding to go to school. So, while I was doing my educational journey, that's when I started the Prison Scholar Fund from out of state. I should kind of throw in a little note there that I was incarcerated in California, then I moved up to Washington State for different crimes up there. And when I was in Washington, they sent me out of state because of overcrowding. And so when I was in out of state, I was at one of those private prisons. So the bad news about being in a private prison is you're a long ways away from home. But the good news is there's really very little oversight. So that means I could write grants all day long from the education department and mail them out to foundations. So from prison, I raised about $60,000, enough money to send 110 people to school. So we had some really great operations from prison. And then that kind of stopped in 2009 when they brought me back to Washington State, because Washington State really didn't give me the ability to have open access in the with the computers and the printers and all that stuff. And also by the time I got to Washington State, I was kind of so successful out of state running the Prison Scholar Fund that they kind of already knew about me and they kept an eye on me.
Wow. So... okay, so kind of taking a step back, even applying to college from prison, like that is a pretty unique process that not a lot of people go through. I think you said you were inspired by others that were, seeking that sort of accomplishment. But curious if you can tell us a little bit more about what that process was like. I can't even imagine the obstacles that you faced. So would you bring us sort of through the steps that you took to even get accepted into Penn State?
Oh, you bet. And actually, that's what you brought up is actually one of the big things that we do at the Prison Scholar Fund, because the application process is really difficult. And even when we have a new student that we're onboarding here, it takes anywhere from 2 to 8 hours to have them enrolled at school. So it's a lot of work, and there's a lot of red tape and administrative stuff to go through. And just being a regular inmate, they might not know all of those, all the way from picking what courses they want to do, their academic journey, actually submitting the paperwork. It's actually quite a bit of work. And so I kind of had the time to figure that out when I was incarcerated. And the application process at Penn State was actually really interesting. Penn State nowadays, and even back in, the mid-2000s when I applied, was really, really selective. I think they had a 6.5% acceptance rate for undergraduates when I was there. Now, of course, there's no way I could apply to Penn State and get in any other sense. But they have the World Campus Distance Education Program. It's basically the same work the students on campus are taking, but the application process is not quite so selective. So I was able to basically just sign up for courses at Penn State, and I kind of came in the back door. But at the same time, I'm doing the same work as everyone else is doing, and my degrees are the same degrees you can get on campus. So that's really exciting to have that opportunity to work, you know, get your education from a world-class institution. And then on top of that, I even, you know, won a bunch of awards at Penn State, you know, competing with my regular classmates.
What sort of awards did you win?
Let's see. I think I started off with the President's Freshman Award for having a 4.0, then the President's Sparks Award for being a sophomore with a 4.0. And then when I graduated, I had the Evan Pugh Scholar Award, which is given to seniors graduating the upper one half of 1% of their class.
Congrats. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was quite a thing.
I mean, I'm trying to picture you in prison with others around you, and you're winning awards, you're graduating from college. What was it like to make connections with others while you were there? And I mean, you know, were you connecting with other inmates that were on a similar track to you? Were you totally unique in what you were doing? I think just any sort of color to your experience.
Yes, like, I hate when people think this is like a unique thing, because, like, granted, I think I'm special, but I'm not really that special. You know what I mean? And that's the thing about prison. Even before I got to prison, I had a misconception of what prison really was. Until you get there, and of course, there's some pretty crazy people in prison, but really, for the most part, they're just regular people like you and I. And that's even more true, because once I get out and I tell my story, I can't tell you how many people I run into, and they say to me, you know what? I was doing the same thing you were doing, they just caught you. So there's so many people in society, they're just normal people that could have had a similar past. But of course, when you're in prison, you meet the people that got caught. And, you know, they're not all horrible people. A lot of people just made mistakes, and they're not bad people, and they're not stupid. So there's a lot of smart people in there. They just don't have an opportunity to reinvent themselves. And the funny thing is, if you really think about prison, who ends up in prison? You know, you have hustlers, you have drug dealers, you have con artists, you have people that sell stolen goods. But the thing about them all is they have hustle. So they understand business. They understand marketing, cost of goods sold, finance, customer acquisition and retention. They're just in the wrong market. You know, they're selling stolen goods. Maybe they should be selling something else.
Totally. And I think that's the value that Prison Scholar Fund brings, right? You're helping these folks really hone in on their strengths, but use them for a different purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. They can reinvent themselves with the same hustle they already have and just apply it to a different context.
Yep. So for you, after you got your degree, what was the inflection point or aha moment when you realized, okay, I'm gonna use this and I'm gonna help other people, not just myself?
I think that was already embedded all along, because I started the Prison Scholar Fund while I was still an undergrad, and it took me about 8 years to get my 4-year degree. So I got my BA and or my BS in 2010. I started the PSF in 2006, and I wasn't really sure if I was going to do that full time when I got out. But then once you see how many people it affects and how much of a change it makes, you know, you kind of fall in love with the mission. And it didn't take long for me to decide that's what I wanted to do.
And so at that time, did you have any mentors, or were you getting any advice that was helping push you in that direction?
Yeah, actually, I had a number of mentors, not very many from prison, but a few. And one of the first one was a textbook author. He actually wrote some really popular psychology textbooks and social psychology textbooks. And I actually wrote to him from prison just to, you know, talk to somebody about psychology, because you see so many of the concepts written about in psychology and social psychology play out in prison. So we just started a friendship over that. And in fact, he was the person that gave us $1,000 way back in 2004 that helped us get the 501c3 off the ground.
Wow. And what were some of the things that he was telling you specifically?
You know, we didn't really have any in-depth conversations about psychology stuff, which I was kind of hoping to have. We just had just a friendship, I guess. We just talked about things every once in a while. And even the $1,000 he gave us for the PSF to get it kicked off, you know, I didn't ask him for that. I never really asked him for anything material, because I didn't want to be that guy in prison hustling people on the streets. So I just kind of kept the friendship just as it's nice to have someone you can talk to every once in a while.
So kind of looking at the path from, you know, the idea of starting the PSF to actually getting your 501c3 4 years later, you know, how did you continue to endure the obstacles and challenges that came your way? What was your motivation to keep pushing forward?
Oh, so yeah, so the motivation, that's a really tough one. It's because I really had no idea what I was doing. So there's a whole lot of exploration about how to start a 501c3, how to do articles of incorporation and bylaws, and how to write grants. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I think part of it was just the adventure of learning something new and just seeing if I could. And then as you just did it, then it became real and it started happening. And then you just kept on going. So I guess you're kind of motivated by the past success from building something from complete unknown. And that's pretty exciting. And you also have to keep in mind that when you're in prison, you don't have too many other things to do. Either you're watching TV or you're playing cards or playing handball or doing push-ups. You know, there's only so many ways to spend your time.
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you pointed out it's you just got to do it. Yeah. So for you, you know, were you scared at all of failing or of risking, you know, your reputation or the chance that you wouldn't get the 501c3 status? How did the risk of failure play into this time for you?
Well, that's really interesting too, because once you're in prison, you're kind of at the bottom. So there's not much further you can fall. So as far as failing to file some paperwork to start a nonprofit officially, well, who cares? You know, as far as failing to understand how to do articles of incorporation, you know, nobody knows. There's no social pushback if, you know, I fail filing some paperwork. So there's really an audience of zero. It's just me. And I'm okay with that.
Totally. So putting your founder hat on for a second, you've been running a nonprofit from prison for 10 years. What qualities do you have from this experience that differentiates you from other founders?
I think the qualities of a founder might be similar because everyone sees an opportunity or sees a change they want to make and they want to do something about it. For, you know, people come from different walks of life on why they want to start nonprofits. So we all have a similar passion for making a change in society, whatever that is. And that's kind of where the founder comes from. But as far as running a nonprofit correctly, the funny thing is, I think a lot of people end up in the position of running a nonprofit without a lot of training. So they show up, they want to start a nonprofit, they don't really know what they're doing. And then I think that's one of the reasons that nonprofits fail so quickly. They have trouble raising revenue, they're not sustainable. You know, because once the founder leaves the picture, there's not really an infrastructure or organizational capacity in place to maintain the organization. And I think it's maybe a little bit different with me, because in that 10 years I was sitting in prison, I probably read about 100 books about nonprofit management, finance, operations, marketing, all this stuff.
Right. Yeah. And so if we dug into one thing that you just mentioned, which is how some organizations, when the founder leaves, they kind of fall apart because that founder maybe didn't share their vision or their passion or their expertise with the rest of the team. Is that something that you try to focus on with PSF now?
Yes, that's a really tough balance. So you really want to have a process in place. So if I get hit by a truck, you know, the PSF can still operate. It's really tough to build that sustainability and that infrastructure while you're trying to keep the lights on, raise money for programs. So it's really challenging, but it's really something that should be done. And a good example of that is I was going to partner with a different nonprofit to do a program, but then I heard that she was leaving the ED position to do something else. And, you know, she didn't have a succession plan in place, and that really creates a lot of risk for the organization. And just like us, we don't really have a succession plan in place either, but we're working on it. And because you really need to answer the question, like, if I stepped out of the picture right now, what would happen to the PSF? Would it just implode? You know, who's going to carry the torch if I'm gone? So that's, you know, it's a really, really important thing to do.
Yeah, how do you tell people that are super passionate about their idea? What advice would you give to someone that is so passionate and so willing to start their organization? What's that first step they should take?
I guess the first step would be to, you know, understand everything about the market, and that includes nonprofit management. So I guess if, you know, where what position are they entering the picture? Do they know something about operating a nonprofit? Do they just know something about the mission? Are they just passionate about the mission? So there has to be an onboarding process, or maybe they could take a certificate course and learn about nonprofit management. You know, there's a whole lot of, like, I guess, due diligence they could do before they got their 501c3. There's a lot of stuff they could, there's online learning tools. You know, maybe they've already done some of that, but it'd be a good place to start.
Definitely. Other advice. So what advice would you give to organizations so that they can highlight and bring out the power of their stories to their constituents, just like you've done?
Okay. So an interesting story is when I got to Stanford for their executive program in social entrepreneurship, I was with a cohort of 52 people from 18 different countries. And I always kind of wondered how I got to Stanford. Maybe just I had a great story and they kind of let me in as looking for diversity. You know, because they didn't have too many criminals in there, so I thought that maybe now they have a full diverse class by having just maybe one of everything. So I was always kind of maybe insecure about how I got there, because you're with 52 brilliant people from across the world, and they're all excellent in what they do. But then on one of my very first classes, it was taught by a professor, Jennifer Aker, and she wrote a book called The Dragonfly Effect. And her whole story that day was connecting the people you serve to external stakeholders. And so for best practices, she had up on the screen in the classroom screenshots from the Prison Scholar Fund's website about how we connect our people and our mission to the world. So on our website, we had pictures of the people we serve. We had a little write-up about what an education means to them and all this stuff. So we just thought it was natural on sharing what we do with everyone, but apparently not everyone does that. So it was really, it's really validating to hear her celebrate what we do as best practices in a case study, because then you realize, oh, heck, hey, I'm here because we're doing it right. I'm not here by accident.
That's awesome. That must have been a really cool moment for you to see you guys, your own organization up on the screen.
Yeah, it was definitely surreal.
So, Dirk, I'm curious, what milestones have you celebrated since being released from prison?
So the first milestone I celebrated when I got out of prison was receiving that certificate from the University of Washington and a class I took, which was nonprofit management. It took me about 6 months to get that. That was pretty cool. So I got that in June of 2015. And then I did the Social Venture Partners Fast Pitch, and I won first place in that in October of 2015. And that was kind of a big deal. I had to do my pitch in front of about 1,000 people at my call hall in Seattle. is a big event. So that was really, really kind of neat. And actually, that event is what kind of got me into Stanford, I think, because that happened on October 27th, and the Stanford application was due November 1st. So I decided that I was going to roll that win into maybe a shot at Stanford, and sure enough, it worked. So Stanford was kind of a big deal for me. After 15 years in prison, you know, now you're at Stanford. So that was pretty awesome. And then, of course, while all this was happening, I applied to the Clasky Awards. And I think there was 1,300 people that applied, give or take. And somehow we ended up in the top 100. So sure enough, shortly after Stanford, you guys flew us out to Boston for the Clasky Awards, which was, you know, really validating. We got recognized as an innovative nonprofit. And even though we didn't get picked for the top 10 out of the top 100, I totally understand why, because after seeing those other people on the stage, we have a long ways to go until we're at their caliber. So it gives us something to shoot for. Another thing that happened is at the Clasky Awards, it's all about connecting, right? So I connected with a guy named Michael, and he was a senior editor for the Stanford Social Innovation Review. He invited me to write an article for it, which I did, and it may or may not be published in February, so we'll see what happens, but there's that. And then another recent win was we managed to get a personal contribution from the president of the University of Washington for a 10-person cohort of prisoners to go through the UW's online program from prison. So now we have funding for a pretty big program, and that's pretty awesome.
So awesome. So much to celebrate. So thinking about milestones, would you have advice for other organizations, how they can remember their own milestones in the midst of the day-to-day grind?
Yeah, so one idea that we actually haven't done yet, but we're going to do, is we're going to get a gong for the office, because whenever we have a win, you know, I think it's important to celebrate the big wins and the little wins. And, you know, whether we, so just to back up a little bit, when I got out, and what we're doing is we're tracking our operations, because we wanted to see, of the 110 people we served, 74 of them have been released, and out of the 74 that had been released, we had to track them all down to see who got in trouble, who's in prison, who's working, who's doing a good job. And it turns out that's a huge job. So it took us about 8 months to do that with a whole bunch of University of Washington volunteer students. And the thing is, every time that someone's trying to find one of these students, it's a major deal. But as soon as they find them, oh my God, it's a huge celebration. So everyone's jumping up and down, running around the office. And we decided that we needed a gong. So like, whenever you have a win, you can do the gong. Or when you get maybe if you get a check from a foundation or something. So you can kind of build into your organization like a cultural celebration or some rituals that make a difference. You know, it keeps things fun, and that's important.
So cool. I love that. Okay, so Derek, last question. What is next for you, and what are you working on now?
Okay, so what's next for us is we have a partnership with Microsoft, and so we have a big data scientist and a senior researcher in the office of the chief economist. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve or answer the question on the efficacy of correctional education. Now, you may be familiar with the RAND study, but there's a RAND study that kind of evaluated correctional education and determined that through correctional education, the odds of coming back to prison decreased by 51% through post-secondary work. And also the odds of getting a job when you're released increased by 13%. But the thing is, the study kind of didn't answer the black box of education, which is how much education is needed, what types of education, how does education affect different crime types, and also what kind of different, maybe I already said that, different types of education, whether it's on-site, paper-based, online, all that stuff. So we have this partnership with Microsoft to really understand how that picture looks, because what we want is we want a turnkey model to understand the inputs that drive the outcomes. And that's a huge data science problem. And so fortunately, smart people like to solve tough problems. So we have some volunteers at Microsoft that are helping us do randomized control trials to really answer the questions. And they have some machine learning algorithms they can attack with this. And we're really happy to have them on board.
That's incredible.
Because yeah, the idea is once you actually have that model down, then you can understand exactly what it takes to drive the change you want. And of course, once we have that, we can scale that nationally.
Totally. Do you have a timeline for that?
Yeah, well, it'd probably be 3 to 5 years, because you have to run the program for about 2 years at least. And then after the two-year program, you would need to wait 3 years for once them to get released from prison, because the definition of recidivism is basically rearrest within 3 years of release. So you'd kind of have to give them a three-year window to get in trouble or not get in trouble. You know, like for some of our students, you know, from the 74 people that we served, only two of them had been in trouble again. So that gives us a 2.7% recidivism rate compared to 68% nationally. And this is kind of where Microsoft comes in, how this whole thing started, because we kind of hand-selected the best people to apply for our program, so we have a little bit of bias selection. And we really want to answer the question of, we're making sure we're measuring apples to apples.
Totally. Well, awesome. Derek, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and learn more about Prison Scholar Fund, and thank you so much for sharing your story and your work with our listeners. To all our listeners, thanks for joining us today. To find more episodes or subscribe to be notified of new ones, just visit www.classy.org/podcast or search for Classy Podcast on iTunes. If you like the show, please let us know by leaving us a review on iTunes. We'd appreciate the feedback. Until then, see you next time.